Hi, welcome to the Meg Pearson Podcast, Fertile at 40. I'm your host, Meg Pearson. After many health complications due to alcohol addiction and an eating disorder that ruled my world for close to 20 years, I was told I would never have children. At 38, I naturally and surprisingly fell pregnant, and the transition from maiden to mother was wrought with love, grief, excitement, and healing. Becoming a mama was about far more than just soothing stitches and learning how to care for a tiny human. It was, and still is, a relearning of who I am and what I am truly capable of. After over two challenging years trying to conceive a second baby since, I gratefully and naturally conceived my second child just as I turned 41, after three losses and heaps of heartache. I am a doula in training, holistic chef, teacher of yoga, and a childbirth educator, and I am here to share my story because I know it's not just mine. Join me each week for unbiased convos with a no-bullshit approach to faith, infertility, conscious conception, and connected pregnancy, with birth stories, expert interviews, and personal anecdotes to help tell the story of creation. Welcome. Now let's do this. Hello, hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Fertile at 40 Podcast. My name is Meg, your host. This episode is going to be going live while I am off on a maternity leave. So this was pre-recorded earlier in the year of 2020. I have an amazing repeat guest on the show, Candace St. John. She was first on the show back on episode number 55 when we discussed adverse childhood experiences and their effects on parenting. So please go back there and have a listen. It's a brilliant conversation and one worth going back to. You can also hear a bit more about her full background and her story as well. So go and check that one out. So Candace is a public health practitioner studying the effects of equity, social determinants of health, and adverse childhood experiences and trauma on lifetime health. And she is a pediatric sleep specialist who uses social media and her work one-on-one with clients and families to teach about how much mainstream advice surrounding infant and child sleep is very limiting, often inaccurate, and lacking proper evidence. To boot, much of what we see and hear about is steeped in privilege, and there is a huge need to understand that everyone doesn't have access to the same options. So today, Candace and I are getting into what biologically normal infant sleep actually is, why many sleep training techniques are not suitable and will not work for many babies, and how bed sharing can be the best option for some families. So without further ado, I'm so excited for this episode. It came at the perfect time for me as I am home with my little new bebe. Here's my conversation with Candace St. John. One last thing before we get into the conversation, I want to remind you that this podcast provides general information and discussion about natural medicine, health, pregnancy, and childbirth related subjects. The content here should not be taken as medical advice, and the content here is for informational purposes only, and because each person is so unique, please consult with your healthcare professional for any medical questions. Now, on with the show. Welcome back to the show, Candace.
Hi, Meg.
So happy to have you back. And today we are talking about sleep, baby sleep, infant sleep. Oh my gosh, something that I know anyone out there that is pregnant or a new mom or in the bouts of those sleepless nights right now is excited to hear about. But we're going to be talking about things a little bit differently here today than what a lot of people might have be used to seeing out on the internets and in social media. We're going to be talking a lot more about biologically normal infant sleep and what that is. So people are probably wondering, give us the rundown. What is biologically normal infant sleep, and why are our expectations too friggin' high right now for our kids?
So like, thanks for having me again, Meg. Candace, so my background, I have a degree in public health psychology, and I had a baby and I decided that I needed to learn, my academic brain. I was looking at all the mainstream advice. It's ridiculous. Was making me feel terrible. So I was like, what, like, what's the research? I got to look behind, like, what's behind the curtain, right? And I realized that there is just not a lot of evidence to support a lot of mainstream infant sleep and toddler sleep advice. So what I had uncovered was that basically a lot of advice is just on these behavioral interventions that are extremely unrealistic for infants to achieve. So one of like the biggest things is, you know, the idea of sleeping through the night, right? That's like the big hot buzzword. That's not biologically typical behavior for infants. We wake at night, all of us, even into adulthood. We assess our surroundings to make sure we're safe, because at the end of the day, our primal brain is still in, you know, kind of like cave people mode. Is there danger? A lot of us don't have that factor any longer. Okay, honey. Your Cheerios are everywhere.
By the way, Candace is a mom of a nearly 2-year-old.
Yes, you'll see him running around. And a lot of us have safe environments now. So you wake, if you have to pee or get a drink or something, you'll get up. And if not, you just go back to sleep. We all have these micro arousals all night. So infants and toddlers still have great need, and they're still figuring out their surroundings. So when they wake, they might call for you, you know, and the only way that they can communicate is crying, and, you know, until they, you know, they're pre-verbal. And that's normal. That is expected. And it's even believed to be protective. Too deep of a sleep might actually not be what we want children to have, because deeper sleep has been linked to SIDS, something that people don't like to talk about. It's just something we need to, you know, to keep in mind. So if we, a lot of our expectations just need to be shifted. Another huge thing that we need to understand is, you know, in terms of biologically typical sleep, a lot of advice just doesn't even account for biology, right? We have circadian rhythm and sleep pressure, homeostatic sleep drive. So these are the two things that dictate sleep in human beings. And up until about 12 weeks, babies don't really have circadian rhythm. So of course they're going to be up, you know, all night long. They might sleep a lot more during the day. So we need to regulate our light, dark cycles. We can do that by getting sun exposure. Those are the things that dictate sleep. It's those two things are, you know, besides getting more sun exposure, you don't like learn to sleep. You know, we have this idea that we have to teach children to sleep or teach them to self-soothe. And these are things that are, you know, quite frankly, kind of ridiculous when you look at the science of it. Because not only how do you teach circadian rhythm and sleep pressure, which is just, it's basically if you're burning energy, and it's believed to be like energy waste build up in your brain, so you need to sleep. So have you ever like taken a test and you're like extra tired after? You might need a nap as an adult. I mean, this is basically children are learning everything, you know, when they're babies, they're like learning to look at any shape is a sensory overload experience. You know what I mean? So that's why they need naps. They just need to download, recharge, and then, you know, make it through the rest of the day. So there's nothing to teach in those two instances. And then like I said, the idea of self-soothing, that is another biological implausibility. Like we talked about this a little bit in the ACEs episode, adverse childhood experiences, but we don't have fully developed prefrontal cortexes, which is our kind of rational thinking part of our brain, until we're about 25. And children need a mature brain to help calm their nervous system. So the idea of self-soothing is quite frankly a myth, because they do not have the integration from their prefrontal cortex to their reptilian brain, or their kind of amygdala and all that, the emotional center of their brain. It's just impossible. They need us to help physically, literally calm themselves. So those are kind of like the biggest biological norms that I like to address, just because I think that's a big shock to a lot of people, given the advice that's out there.
Yeah. And I mean, and I fell prey to this idea of, you know, I sleep trained our first daughter, or we, at least we sleep trained her, but she probably just slept on her own. Really, she learned how to do all of that on her own. But, you know, I mean, back in the ACEs episode where you were here, we're talking about adverse childhood experiences and how they affect, you know, how we as parents parent our children, right? And there's a lot of influence for me. I knew like, oh, I need my daughter to sleep through the night because I need to go back to work. And, you know, there was a lot of conditioning for me that it's like, I can't, how could I possibly be up and consoling her? She needs to be able to sleep on her own. And so we did about 12 weeks in with our daughter, we did an online course and we started implementing a lot of the things that the instructor was telling us to do. And it seemed to be working, but at the end of the day, we were still, you know, soothing her and helping her get back to sleep. And I think honestly, looking back, and I know this, I've been saying this my whole pregnancy, we are 27 weeks pregnant. I'm like, I think she likes sleep, you know, like she's one of those really good sleeping babies. And I'm not sure how much what we did had to do with anything. Do you think that's a pretty good assumption?
Yes. So that's I love that you brought that up because I'm sure a lot of people have heard of the three different temperament types, right? Of children. There's easygoing, slow to warm, and then highly sensitive. I personally like there's nine temperament characteristics because like my son, he doesn't like fit neatly in one of those boxes. He's kind of like in between slow to warm and sensitive, but there's been there's like a correlation between like the sensitive babies. A lot of them end up being a little bit more like lower sleep needs, and the more easygoing babies end up being kind of higher sleep needs. And it's just like, that's just something that's been observed. It's not necessarily like evidence-based. I think there actually might be some evidence for the highly sensitive children needing less sleep. It's like correlated with like brilliance and such, but yeah, I mean, there's the temperament factor. Like some babies, when you go to sleep train them, some of these techniques where you place them in the crib and you just give them a couple bum pats, they're like, cool. Like I'm good.
Yeah.
You know, I feel comfortable already. Like okay. As we were talking about trauma before and in the other episode, you know, that's why trauma affects people differently because people have different, it's called window of tolerance. I'm sure that you are aware of Dr. Dan Siegel. Uh-huh. So it's a window of tolerance and it's, you know, all these things can happen during the day. It will make your nervous system kind of like a little woo, but you can keep it in check. And babies obviously have a small window of tolerance already because they're babies. They can do self-settling behaviors, which is, you know, like suck their thumb if they're not dysregulated out of the window of tolerance, which would be, you know, hyper aroused. So crying, having a fit, and you know, on the other end is shut down, dissociation, if you will. If you are easygoing, your window is probably a lot bigger than a highly sensitive baby's window of tolerance. So that's why sometimes sleep training, it seems gentle and not like a big deal to some babies. Like, you know, I would never demonize sleep training. I don't like it because of my background with adverse childhood experiences and what I know. And I can't say no one should ever do it because that's just false. Like some babies like literally are not distressed in the slightest by any of those techniques because they already feel so secure and so settled in their environment. And that's probably how your daughter was. I mean, that just some babies are really easygoing and some are just not. Like my son, for example, because it was about the same. I'd say it was around like 10 weeks. We started going down the sleep training route and I like to call it, we were groomed because I didn't know it was sleep training. I felt like groomed honestly into it because they were like telling us all these things. And, you know, I don't know if you've heard of like Dr. Harvey Karp's 5 S's, like the sway, soothe, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. This kid, like none of it. I was like, you'd think that I was trying to like hurt him the way that he would scream when we were just doing the 5 S's,
wow,
which are supposed to be calming, right? But, you know, that's why some of these claims are quite egregious that they have out there. He claims that elicits the calming reflex, which is not evidence-based, which I learned after digging. Because obviously if it was, it would work for every baby. And it doesn't, like, because clearly it caused great dysregulation to my child. And that's why I think it just I don't think there's any harm. You want to try it, that's fine. Sleep training. And 5S's aren't sleep training, but this is just something I want parents to be aware of like, it's okay to tap into like your child, like listen to your child. If that's not working, there's nothing wrong with your child. There's something wrong with what we're doing. Like that analogy of, if a flower isn't blooming, try to pry open the petals, right? You try to fix the environment. We ensure there's enough sun. We make sure the soil is fertilized and, getting enough water. So we have to look at those external factors that are affecting our children and really look at ourselves too, because I know I was dysregulated oftentimes because I was like, why isn't this working? Why is my kid suck? I was like, wow, I got a broken one. You're like, what happened here? So it's like, it's sometimes we get so caught up, like I love evidence, but we get too caught up in that evidence-based stuff where it can like just hinder common sense, you from using your own common sense. And it's funny because as I've gone down the sleep route, you peel back the layers of the onion and evidence-based is pretty loose. Mm-hmm. I'd say that's pretty, it's kind of accepted by those who like to call themselves evidence-based, such as like doctors, when it's just like kind of bullshit that's been, it was like a snowball that kind of rolled down a hill and turned into like this big, snowman at the bottom of the hill that people have just like accepted over time when it's just a load of crap. I mean, that's what some of this stuff is when you really look at it. So yeah, I could go on forever with this stuff too.
So I want to ask the question because I'm sure a lot of people that are listening out there, I mean, I know a lot of my friends and my community we've all chosen to work in the sleep department with our children differently. And I know that there are a lot of people I know that are very highly, deeply against sleep training. And yet I've seen them all really suffering up till 5 years old with no sleep for anyone in the family. What are the alternatives? How can we support our babies and our infants and our toddlers, allowing them to be who they are and meet them where they're at, and also keep sane and get sleep. So like what kind of tips and tools do you offer the families that you work with when they're, they're trying to come at this in a more natural and biologically normal approach?
Yeah. Great, great question. So yeah, it's always brought up as this false dichotomy of like it's sleep training or wait it out. And obviously there's many shades in between. The first thing that I do when I work with families and other kind of holistic sleep coaches or pediatric sleep specialists will do is first we want to rule out any discomfort. You want to look at, is there a medical issue that is in the way? Is it reflux? Is it ineffective feeding? Is it that they have kind of like torticollis, like that they're like in pain, like they can't sleep a certain way, so it's uncomfortable for them to lie a certain way? Do they have sleep apnea? There's different things that we can be looking out for. And once those medical issues are addressed, a lot of these families are low iron. I had a family, we just started upping the iron in the child's diet. And I mean, the child stopped having, like, they were just restless all night and they're able to sleep like 5 hour chunks now. So it's just, sometimes it's more than just sleep. Like we have to really kind of tune into what's the family dynamic. Because another thing that, attachment and emotional needs really do play a huge role in sleep, because some children are waking up at night because if you're at work all day, you're maybe with your child for like an hour, a waking hour all day. They miss you. They need that connection. So they might be waking up at night because they need you. They just need to have that closeness and they need to reconnect. So, something might be as simple as like 10 minutes of like one-to-one. You don't have your phone, you have nothing else, you're not petting the dog as well. You have that focused attention on your child. So that's another huge one, is kind of meeting those emotional needs. Some babies do wake because they're still hungry and thirsty. And that's biologically typical. So there's, with a lot of things, like again, it's a mindset shift, and like radical acceptance is really huge. I think understanding typical infant wake patterns, understanding that sleeping through the night is not, not only does no one really do it, but that term is completely misused. It's like a research term that has like three different definitions from like 5 hours to 8 hours. So it's like not, it's not like a standard, it's not 12 hours. Like a lot of sleep trainers like to, you know, play it up as, waking isn't going to affect a baby or toddler's development. There's no research on that, demographic. When people like sleep trainers like to use that, understanding that your child is not going to be deprived, unless they are like physically seeming like exhausted all day, they're probably getting the sleep that they need. So it's like kind of letting go of a lot of these, just crappy expectations, that will really help you kind of get in a better mindset of letting go of the things that are, you know, just literally infeasible for a child. So, and I know for me and a lot of other families, like just having that, like letting go, surrendering moment. And then also working on other things like tweaking environment, you know, ensuring it's not too hot or too cold, or they're not itchy, or like, there's so many factors, right? Yeah, that it really can help with your sleep too, because like, yes, we might have fragmented sleep by helping our children to sleep when they wake up. But I promise you, your kid, unless they're like, you know, a lot of times they're just having micro arousal, so then they're going right back to sleep. So yeah, feeding them to sleep is fine. It's fine. Sucking, it's in and of itself is soothing. It is fine. You know, trying to let people know that that's totally cool.
That's the one thing that everyone says, oh God, if you're feeding your baby to sleep, then you're setting yourself up for disaster, because they'll never know how to put themselves to sleep. Right. Mm-hmm. That's what we hear all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a huge one. And again, it's just, if you look at a lot of different, people who don't go the sleep training route, or take a look at, you know, my very sensitive child, especially around sleep, I nurse them to sleep for every sleep, because nursing is still working for us, so we're still doing it. And I put them to bed by nursing, and then when I go to bed, you know, we bed share. You know, sometimes he might wake up when I, you know, want a little bit more milk, but I rarely, unless he's teething, am woken by him at night for nursing. So it's like, so yeah, he's not like independently sleeping, but he'll sleep in there independently for hours before I go to bed. You know, it's just, I didn't have to do anything except for show him that I would show up every time that he wakes. So, and I think that really means something, you know?
Yes. And I mean, that's all our kids want, right? They just want right. us to be there. And right. So you just mentioned bed sharing. So I would love to just talk about that real quick. I know that, you know, I am still figuring out what our plans are going to be for this new baby, but also just surrendering to the fact that he might be the one that makes the choice for all of us when he mm-hmm. gets here. With my daughter, we had, she had a little cot right beside the bed, and that was handy. That was mostly because I had fears about proper bed sharing at the time. Lo and behold, obviously breastfeeding through the night, there was many nights where she would fall asleep on top of me and we would both snooze half the night away, snuggled up in bed. And I would wake up and have a bit of panic about it.
Yeah.
And so I've got a cot again for our son, whether or not we use it, I don't know, because I feel like second baby, everything's a little bit looser and I'm like, we might just all sleep in the bed together. And that's probably going to be
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about bed sharing here. And I know that it's still, you know, there's controversy around it, which is kind of ridiculous because it is the way that we've done it for all of eternity, right? As human species, apes do, it's what we do. So let's just talk about that and dispel any myths that people might still have around the idea of bed sharing.
Absolutely. This is one of the biggest reasons I came to the internet is, it's actually a perfect alignment between my public health hat and, my pediatric sleep, specialist hat, because here's the thing, in the United States, we are like the only country that is, really against bed sharing. And even for a country that's really against it, in 2016, AAP updated their safe infant sleep guidelines to be a little bit more, inclusive of the fact that especially those who are lactating, or be up tending to your, you know, baby at night, feeding them, you get sleepy. And they finally acknowledged that the safest place for you to be is to be in an adult bed. My biggest thing is I want them to go further. I want them to follow suit with the UK, the Red Nose Australia. If you look at Canada, they're changing their guidance in terms of bed sharing to show risk reduction models to parents, because it does jack shit to help parents safely care for their child at night when they are exhausted by saying, don't do it. Because that's what a lot of pediatricians in the US, even though that guidance has been updated, they haven't been relayed that information. And a lot of that boils down to people just don't trust in parents. I mean, that's kind of what it is. And instead, you're just going to, my husband says this like awesome phrase, and I'm terrible at remembering phrases. He's like, you know, keep us as mushrooms or something, feed us shit and keep us in the dark. Something like that. I might have messed it up completely, but it's true. It's like they think that by, you know, just saying don't do it, that's how you're going to save babies, when it's like, in reality, we know that of the data that we have conclusively pinpointed SIDS or sudden unexpected infant death, so SUIDs, they have been, it was like 75% are linked to excess bedding and like pillows and crap in the bed when the child is asleep. And when I say bed, when in the United States, it's also terrible data, because bed sharing is when they fall asleep on the couch or when they fall asleep in a chair as well. Yeah. And that's bullshit. I mean, I'm sorry, that's skewing the data, because if you're telling me that if you told parents that, okay, if you're tired, please just strip your bed, take the blankets off, wear something warm, lay down in the bed, you would, I believe you would see that 75% number drop drastically, because people like me, like very early on, they just told us when we left the hospital, don't sleep, don't fall asleep with your baby. We were falling asleep on the couch. That's so dangerous. They can slip and fall between the cushions. They can have positional asphyxia. I mean, there's so many things that can go wrong. And once I started doing my own review of information and looking at guidance from reputable, you know, organizations around the globe, I'm like, we're just ass backwards in the United States. And it's really sad, because infants' lives are at stake. And I think that we get so caught up in, like, especially scientists, it's called confounding variables. So you want to try to eliminate them as much as possible. So they're like, oh, well, if we just say, you know, don't sleep in the bed, that eliminates the beds as a variable. And it's like, well, or like, oh, you know, unsafe sleep surfaces, so anything but a crib, then, you know, that means our data is going to be beautiful and perfect. And it's like, well, humans are anything but that. And unless you're going to give me an injection or something that says, that helps my body not get tired when prolactin and oxytocin are being produced to produce milk, which also make you drowsy as a lactating parent if you're doing that, but also, like, who isn't tired in the middle of the night when they're caring for their child? That's bullshit. Like, you're never going to eliminate the human factor here. And the best thing that we can do is create environments that are safer for our babies. Right? So give people information and then hope that they do, you know, the best they can, as opposed to not giving them information, just saying they better sleep in the crib or you're an asshole, terrible shit parent. And I hope you feel like the worst parent in the world if something bad happens, which is what happens. Like these stories of what parents have gone through, I'm like, no parent should feel that way. Like, that's not right. And we need to be, you know, sharing this information with, like, other caregivers as well. Cause like daycares, you know, terrible things are kind of like day homes where people kind of just like watch other people's children as opposed to like a legitimate, daycare facility. They need this information too, because we need to, you know, help keep, children as safe as possible. And, yeah, that's my stance on bed sharing. And I think that, you know, I'm actually going to be launching a healthcare toolkit in the fall once I get around to actually making it. But I want them to, healthcare providers to understand biologically normal infant sleep, as well as as well as, you know, risk reduction messaging. He's saying hit me with the pillow.
Candace is getting the beat down with the pillow fight from her son right now.
Silly guy. Your hair is in your face, huh? You want it to be cut? I know. I would love for you to let me cut your hair. You won't let me every time I try.
So funny.
So yeah, that's one of my things is I want providers to take more of a risk reduction standpoint based on data. And, you know, the current way in which a lot of them operate is not based on great evidence. So,
That's the problem across the board with so much of the information that we're given, not only in you know, our infant care, but even like in pregnancy. Oh my gosh, the things that we're told that we cannot do when we're pregnant because there's a small chance of something happening. So the easiest thing to do is for healthcare providers to just say, full stop, don't do it, don't eat it, don't try it, don't this, don't that. Where when you look deeper into all of the actual real evidence, it's like, you know, the chances of any of that stuff actually causing harm is so minute that it really should be up to the mothers to make the choice. You know, it should 100% and the fathers and the caregivers, the parents, the birthing people, you know,
or at least be given. At least be given. What are the odds and what is the risk and what does it look like if that happens?
Yeah.
So, and that's, I think, so much better than saying like, don't you dare eat deli meat or whatever.
Yeah.
Not that I love deli meat anyway, but you know, just people get really caught up and then, you know, they find out that there was a little bit of something in what they were eating or, you know, exposed to or what have you. And then they're in a tizzy and
panic. Yeah.
As we talked about adverse childhood experiences, 0 to 7, if your parent is experiencing toxic stress, that is very bad in utero. Mm-hmm. That's not good for a parent to have a lot of stress. So, and again, I don't think that every parent is going to be super stressed, but some people get, you know, really bad anxiety and some people get really worked up about things because trauma is a spectrum. And you
know, whoa. Camera down.
Wow. I'm just going to hold it for now. Somebody's getting antsy.
Well, I think that is our sign that we'll wrap it up here. You share tons of information on social media about all of this stuff that we talk about. I'm sure a lot of people out there want to hear, you know, what you have to say about, you know, what is safe bed sharing and all of that, but you have so much of that kind of information on your Instagram account. So why don't you share with people where they can find that and find you?
Yeah. So you can find me. You want milkies. I know. So you guys can find me at CandaceSt.John.mph. So Master of Public Health is what that is. I have tons of information all over my page. I have some guides on there. And I actually, in the next few weeks, will be having a safer infant sleep bed sharing webinar. So stay on the lookout for that.
Yes.
It's been, a lot of people have been asking me for that for a while now, and I'm finally getting around to it. And the evidence informed with all of the, you know, the latest information from around the globe. So.
Amazing.
So stay on the lookout for that.
Perfect. And I'll be putting a link to your socials and all of that in the show notes so people can check that out. Thank you so much, Candace. I'll let you go to attend to that little man of yours.
Thank you, Meg. It's great chatting.
Thanks so much for listening. Please, if you would be so kind, I would be grateful if you could share, subscribe, rate, and review the show. Please follow the show over on Instagram at Fertile@40podcast and share what you thought about this week's episode. Don't forget to tag us. For more info on today's show, please head on over to the podcast website at meganpearson.ca/podcast. Until next time.